Hi, all. These are generally conversations between adults after the children have left the table. The language can be spicy and the subjects can get saucy. So if you're ready, you are listening to The Southern Fork, a podcast that hosts kitchen chats with some of the most interesting people in the culinary South. I'm your host, Stephanie Burt, and I'm always hungry to learn more. Let's dig in. The Southern Fork is supported by Bake From Scratch. Voted number one hottest magazine launch in 2016. You've probably seen it while waiting in line at the grocery store. Hint, it's the one with those beautiful covers that make you think, I need to make that tart, or those cookies, or wow, I wish I had cake right now. I've been thrilled and honored to write for this publication a couple of times, but even more than that, I really love baking from it. The recipes are tested, the stories are interesting, and I have these pages to thank for adding rose water to my classic pound cake. It's easy to subscribe by going to bakefromscratch.com. While there, check out some recipes and the Bake From Scratch cookbook too. Hello, easy gift. And remember, baking and cooking is about being fearless to try something new. Visit bakefromscratch.com today to learn more and get inspired to bake your best this holiday season. The first time I met Ian Bowden, I thought he was quiet. Really, I don't know what I was thinking. But it was probably because I met him minutes before an event where he was going to serve close to 100 people in an hour. He was focused. And it's that kind of focus that has garnered him two James Beard nominations, all from a little spot called The Shack in Stanton, Virginia. That's a 26-seat place in a town in the middle of the Shenandoah Valley, so you know it must be good. Especially since you can't see a menu online. Especially since you probably have no idea where Stanton really is. And especially since you're more than likely not sure how rye berries are even supposed to taste, or that lettuce could even be a soup. Relax. Ian knows what he's doing. Although he wasn't born to it, he's channeling Appalachian heritage through the plate, filtered through fine dining experience and his Jewish heritage. If that still doesn't make sense, once again, just imagine relaxing and having a good meal that surprises and satisfies. Ian has been cooking since he was 13, and although he has many opinions on the theory of cooking and how to approach it, he never forgets his focus to bring people together over a meal. We are all welcome at his table.
Welcome to the Southern Fork, Ian.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and welcome, listeners, to the second Kia Sportage Edition. Oh, God. We're once again sitting in the back of Stephanie's car to discuss food in a parking lot, because I'm in the middle of a food festival. Hey, Manish, you know a thing or two about this, but Ian is ready to sit in full sun and sweat and talk for 20 minutes about Appalachian foodways because he cooks at the Shack in Stanton, Virginia. So we've just finished a panel. You had to be really polite.
Way too polite. Anybody who's ever heard me speak publicly or on a podcast knows that I get nasty sometimes.
But it was a self-imposed.
It was. No one told me to do it, but I just felt it was appropriate for the environment. My mother and my wife would be very proud that I watched my P's and Q's.
Well, excellent.
But that shit's over now.
That shit is so over. But I actually want to go sappy immediately and talk about something that you mentioned in the panel that really translates to any cuisine, Appalachian or no. And that was the idea that you cook from the heart. Because I hear that all the time.
Most of the time it's bullshit.
And most of the time it's bullshit. Mm-hmm. Because people can say that. They don't. They cook from memory. Or they cook from... Some people cook from the thing of, hey, I want to be on television right. now. I mean, I'm sure you see a lot of line cooks that come in
totally.
Like that.
People cook for the wrong reasons.
Right. But cooking from the heart is a very vulnerable place to cook from. And I think you have a really interesting perspective on it because you did not grow up where you live and the style.
The regionality
that you bring to the shack is not your home cooking that you grew up with. So talk about how your heart got injected there.
To be honest, I mean, first off, I mean, you know, when you've got, you know, so I was in New York City prior, and to build a restaurant in New York City, you're looking at minimum, you know, $2 to $5 million to open a restaurant in New York City. When you have that kind of stress on you and that kind of pressure and financial restraint over your head, it's really hard to cook from the heart. You cook from the head because you have to produce food. You have to be competitive immediately. There's no room for error. Your family's livelihood, your career, your name all relies on you doing well. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel that you can always cook from the heart. There's exceptions. Thank you. But generally speaking, with that kind of pressure, how can you cook from the heart?
Right.
You know?
Right. And then that's not, you weren't cutting down people by saying that you can't always do that.
Maybe I need to rephrase. Maybe it's just me who can't do that. Maybe there is people who can. Mm-hmm. I'm just not one of them. I'm one of those cats who has their emotions on their sleeve at all times and causes me lots of anxiety and stress on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I can't perform under circumstances like that. I can't mm-hmm. cook my food. Additionally, I don't think that you cook from the heart immediately, despite what people think.
I think you
really need to learn the technicality of cooking, the technique, the skill. There has to be inherent skill involved prior to cooking with your heart, because you need to be able to learn all of these skills and then forget them so you can cook from the heart.
So you learn a language.
Yeah,
so,
totally. It's exactly. It's just like learning a foreign language.
So even if you're a home cook, you've learned to cook technically the type of cooking, like from your grandmother or your mom or whatever. So you've learned your lexicon.
Yeah,
so
totally.
To speak.
Totally. You have your skill set. You have the mm-hmm. basics. I mean, that's what we look for in a cook on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. We want you to come in with this basic set of skills. And from mm-hmm. that basic set of skills, we can help you accomplish your goal. Mm-hmm. But without that basic set, it's really hard, mm-hmm. you know, to grow.
So what was the first dish, if you can recall, that you were going to think when you knew this is heart cooking?
So there's the whole story of Grandma Tizzy's gravy. So Grandma Tizzy is my wife's, the matriarch of my wife's family. It was her grandmother. And she passed, in her, I think her early 50s, prior to me meeting my wife. I never got a chance to meet her, but I heard about her food all the time. I made light bread, mm-hmm. today for the sorghum tasting. Mm-hmm. And that light bread is based on a recipe from Grandma Tizzy.
Just as an aside, mm-hmm. I have an Appalachian grandmother, had an Appalachian grandmother too. And so I grew up tasting and eating mm-hmm. this stuff. So we might talk shorthand.
Right.
So light bread is actually white bread. Yes. So I knew what he was saying. And so I was nodding.
It's lard white bread though.
Right. Oh, okay.
So since I'm the Jew, I put schmaltz. I made pork schmaltz and used that for the light bread. So yeah.
Well but that's not the recipe that you're talking about.
That's not the recipe.
So I
learned about Grandma Tizzy through my wife, via food that I'd never gotten to taste. Mm-hmm. And so the big deal was the first Thanksgiving I cooked with my wife in her house. And so Thanksgiving, I don't know if it's like this all through Appalachia. I have a feeling it is. About 30 people come through the house, mm-hmm. over the course of 5 or 6, sometimes 10 hours. People coming in and out all day long. And that's not how I grew up at all. We had a formal Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Everybody showed up. We spent the whole day together. Dad smacked us in the back of the heads, told us to hurry up and go get the extra chairs, that kind of thing. Right.
That was my childhood.
Right on.
So I did not have the shift through kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was we dress up, we come here, here's the mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was. So this is a very different Thanksgiving than I'm used to. And on top of that, I'm tasked with making Grandma Tizzy's gravy, which, mind you, I've never eaten before in my fucking life. I've never seen, I've never smelt. So the first year, this is how many years ago? This is at least, it's about 10 years ago now. So the first Thanksgiving, my wife was like, no, not even close. And I was like, well, what is it? She's like, well, it needs to taste more like flour. I was like, what the fuck? Gravy's not supposed to taste like flour. It's supposed to taste like gravy.
Right.
So the next year I made it, and she's like, it's a little bit better, but it needs to taste a little burnt. I'm like, what are you talking about? Burnt, floury mush to pour over turkey. That's what you want. She's like, well, kind of. I'm like, okay, whatever. The third year I nailed it. And so,
but the direction was helpful.
It was, but it didn't make any sense. I just, you know,
it's almost like developing your own language. She kind of knew where she was.
I'm channeling Grandma Tizzy through my wife. It's awesome. Very bizarre, and I don't know how it's happened, but it's worked.
It works.
You know, the first time I nailed the gravy, my wife welled up with tears and it killed me. It's killing me now. You know, to be able to bring that to my wife and to her family and to have them feel what they haven't felt since she's passed is huge for me.
Because that taste memory, I'm sorry, we're going to have a moment in the back of the Kia as we're sweating. That taste memory is something.
It's everything.
That you don't realize that you miss.
Yeah.
I mean, you want that. And it's not the same as having the actual memory.
Yeah.
Because really, the memory is yours alone. It will be different. Grandma Tizzy would have a different memory of
food
that gravy.
Food is about sharing.
Right.
Especially when you're doing a meal like that.
Right.
And to be able to share that.
Right.
There's, I would not trade that moment in our relationship for any moment
so
I've
you
ever had
to
before
technically
in my life.
Technically know how to make gravy.
So, no, but what happened, honestly, the way I got to it is by forgetting what I know as a chef. So what I learned when I moved to this region is really, okay, yes, I can make fucking, you know, whatever, beurre blanc. I can perfectly poach whatever. Mm-hmm. So fucking what? Let's forget this and let's learn how to cook. I mean, I remember the first time I made a pot of soup beans or field peas. And I'm like, these are good, but why does everyone love this so much? It doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. And then the day that I let them sit on the stove for 4 hours and went back and tasted, it's like, oh, there's all the fucking umami. There's all the flavor. There's everything that I've been after. Mm-hmm. And it's because I've been taught to cook my beans until they're this tenderness, and now like I'm now eating and I'm like, these beans suck, they're fucking starchy, what's going on?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's a total shift. So it's having the basic skill set, learning how to cook, forgetting how to cook, and then approaching it. You have to approach it like a grandma. You have to approach it like a housewife who's been doing this all of her life. You have to approach it, you know, like grandpa who made the best, you know, country hams, whatever it is. I mean, it's forgetting the technical side and relearning how to cook. And that's what I had to do.
Well, you're kind of fucking killing it.
You've
been so busy that you haven't had time to put up anything this season.
It's been really frustrating, actually. So it's a blessing and a curse. It's the problem you want to have. The restaurant has...
It's a destination wedding. Destination wedding. You can tell I live in Charleston.
Yeah, right.
It's a destination restaurant.
We have that in the Valley, too.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a destination restaurant.
It is. We've been really blessed to get a lot of great attention. You know, I've been, you know, lucky to get some nominations that were completely unexpected and very exciting. And so, yeah, we've grown substantially. I mean, our business has gone up, you know, 15 to 25% year over year, and we're going into our fourth year.
And you don't have that $2 to $5 million build out.
I have no debt hanging over my head. At all.
So the freedom to be creative and expressing.
It's okay to mess up. It's okay to fuck up. You know, as long as your guests can forgive it, which in this day and age, it's harder for them to forgive, but my local clientele mostly will forgive. You know, one of the things that's taken out of our, I don't even know how to put it. One of the things that's really sucks about our industry right now is that we're under a microscope from everybody. We're under a microscope from
me.
Well, not you.
Just
but
kidding.
The media
you're
at
under
large,
a microscope with me too. Come on, he's
media,
just being nice.
Well, you've worked for bigger media. Big media.
I work for big media.
You know about
hey,
this.
Hey, timing.
So
what's going on?
So you know, so we've got the media having us under a microscope. We've got quote unquote special peer review websites that trash us on a regular basis, and everybody expects us to perform everything to a T every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we are human. And yes, you are paying for a service. And yes, I want everybody to leave my restaurant exhilarated and excited about the food. But the reality is that it's not going to happen every time.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a bad meal from time to time,
right,
you know,
right.
And it's okay to tell me, In the right circumstances. You know? Blasting me on Facebook or on social media, you know, to show everybody what a great troll you are is not, you know, route to go.
No.
You know, I'm in this business because I love it. I cook from the heart as much as I possibly can. I do everything I can to ensure a positive experience for all my guests, you know, and I slip.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, it happens. Mm-hmm. And doesn't mean that you deserve for me to slip on your table. And if it happens to your table, I'm really sorry. And if I'm made aware at the time, I will do everything in my power to make it up to you. Mm-hmm. Danny Myers has, I can't remember the quote exactly, but from his, I can't even remember the name of his book.
It's okay.
But he basically said that you turn any negative experience into a regular guest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. When you mm-hmm. drop the ball and you know, bend over to do everything you can to turn an experience around for somebody.
Right.
You've made a regular guest.
Yes. Yes.
You know, totally. When they see the extent that you'll go to fix a mistake or an error, or even if it's a dish that they don't care for, not that it's prepared improperly,
right.
but that they don't care for it.
Right.
Go out of the way for them. They'll go out of the way for you.
Yeah. Well, because that is the thing. Food is a language and it's a sharing and it's a communication. And I think that I mentioned that it's the thing that drives me is that I realized one day that I could hear what you guys were saying through food. And I mean, guys as gender neutral, but I could hear y'all folk were saying. I don't think I've ever said it that
Uh-oh.
Way. wait, we're saying these guys.
These guys.
And,
bring the yank back up.
But, I realized I could taste and I can tell who's cooking from what perspective mm-hmm. in a very visceral way. But there's something about that. And I think that everybody can, if you mm-hmm. just focus, if you just focus on that communication moment, then you're like, oh, right.
So what younger chefs and cooks need to learn is they don't learn that communication like day one in the kitchen. And this is another big issue in our industry in general. Is people think that they've developed their voice when they're 26 years old and are the chef of their first restaurant. And it's like, dude, you don't know shit. You don't. Mm-hmm. I don't say that to step on anybody. I was exactly the same. My first restaurant, I was a pompous prick and I know it. I know mm-hmm. it now. You know, and I'm saying this only because it's only in the last couple of years mm-hmm. that you could say that about my food. And mm-hmm. I started when I was 13 years old. I'm turning 40. You know, mm-hmm. I've been doing this for 27 years. And now in the last 4 years, I've really developed my own voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's distinct from everybody else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is a long way to go around about a pantry, isn't it?
No, that's fine. How do you feel that you lead in the kitchen these days?
So I have a really small team. So that doesn't mean that the leading is less important. It's just very different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have a big kitchen staff, well, I don't have a general manager either, so I kind of have to lead the whole restaurant. Mm-hmm. We're only 26 seats though. Mm-hmm. I would love the help.
Just heads up, it's only 26 seats, so if you're going to drop out there.
Make a reservation.
Don't get there and be
not at 7 and 7:30.
And scene. Okay, back to what we were saying.
So, leading is a different story when you have a small team, mm-hmm. especially a team. Like, most of my staff has been with me since my first restaurant, my front of the house staff in particular.
So you lead in a way that works for the people that are with you.
Because
the longevity of their tenure has to be evidence of that.
You know, they put up with me for the money for a while, and now they put up with me because they believe in me.
That's really great.
You know, they make good money.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm sure that's kept them around longer than most people would have.
Uh-huh.
But now they believe in what we do. I mean, they drank the Kool-Aid a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
Which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
do you cook for them?
I don't. And it's really just a logistical issue.
Do you cook with them in mind though? Like when you're developing a dish?
When I make a dish that I know a specific waiter will love,
uh-huh.
I make sure that they taste it.
That's
and
awesome.
They sell the shit out of it.
That
always
is awesome.
Always, because I know their palates and I know what they connect with always.
Yes.
And actually that's a great way to have your translator for the table as well.
Yeah.
Going back to food as communication.
And really actually breaking down that barrier between front of house and back of house.
I don't believe in a barrier between the front of the house and back of house. We're all there for the same reason. Nothing. When I took over my first kitchen, nothing frustrated me more than the bickering between the front and the back. And it still happens in my restaurant now. It's inevitable when there's such a, you know, income discrepancy between the two. Mm-hmm. And I would love to narrow that discrepancy, but it's really challenging, especially mm-hmm. in a smaller restaurant in a small community.
Mm-hmm. But that translator.
But I always try to put the kibosh on that shit. Right. It drives me crazy because we're all there for the same reason. If you're there for yourself, you're there for the wrong reason.
Right.
And we're in the service industry. And if you don't like being in the service industry, then you should really find another fucking job. Right.
Because it is a legitimate industry. Mm-hmm. It is also an industry where you can make money fast, mm-hmm. and it is a place to land when you need to make money yep. fast. However, more and more people, I think our generation, you and I's mm-hmm. generation, was really the first to see it as...
In the States, yes.
In as the a States, career, right. Not career, Europe yes. and, yep. and other continents.
Definitely. I agree 100%.
But I think Generation X was the first to really say, okay, this is...
We also had the 50s and 60s where those old school maitre d's were, you know, but there was definitely a gap.
But there was a European influence to that, right. those maitre d's. 100%. But actually going to places nowadays, like Smith, hey, John and Karen. Yeah. Also, like Bastion, when I went last year mm-hmm. in Nashville, and you don't know who was who. I mean, you know who's cooking, but the chef is serving that, or you don't know. Is that person that's seating me the psalm?
You have no idea.
I mean, you just have no idea. You're just in someone's living room.
You shouldn't. You should be taken care of.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And you were just taken care of. And so there was less pretension because you know that you can talk to that person. Do you like going out and talking to guests?
Yes and no. Because of the size of my dining room, as small as it is, an extra body in that dining room gets very tricky. On top of that, I have to produce food the whole time I'm there because mm-hmm. there's two of us in the kitchen. Fridays and Saturdays especially, we do mostly prefix menu, so it's mm-hmm. three or four courses. So we have two people turning out food for 60 to 70 people, all of which are having 3 to 4 courses. So we're talking,
it's,
you know, well over 150 plates of food.
Extremely timed.
Yes.
It's extremely timed. So, I think people don't understand yeah. that time.
It gets sensitive. Yeah. and so
they don't want to come out and be like, hey, Ian.
Well, so sometimes people, you know, regular guests or new guests will poke their head in the kitchen because you can't avoid the kitchen because it's right next to the bathroom. And I know that sounds funky, but it's a
but
shack.
But you love the funk.
It's a fucking shack.
You love the funk.
I do love the funk.
We're going to talk about the funk okay,
so,
in a minute.
So, you know, so when it slows down, yes, if I'm more than happy to go in the dining room. Once again, with the size of the dining room, it's very easy for me to say hi to one table and then have to go to every other single table in the dining room, which I love to have the time to do. But the reality is I end up cutting somebody off because yeah. I have to get back in the kitchen.
Right.
And I don't like doing that.
Right.
So
it's like guests at a table, like Thanksgiving. You don't want to not talk to that one
right,
on the other end of the table.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that's actually really nice. I've never heard a chef say that, Ian. But let's not get all sappy again. We've already done that
we
twice.
We did that once. Yeah, let's
just
move on.
It was actually twice, but okay. I'll let you go. Let's just end this chat with having a real big discussion of the funk.
But which one?
I know. You have so many. You have an intense love for the funky.
It probably comes from music and my family.
Really?
Yeah, my brother's a musician. My dad was a musician. I played drums for years. Yeah, we like some soul music.
Yeah.
We like some funk.
But in the kitchen, mm-hmm. there's this, you like the fermented stuff. Mm-hmm. You like the umami stuff. You like the sour stuff. You like the stuff that's like, you're going to push it.
Well,
you're just pushing it a little bit.
It's funny because my food is actually really subtle, but I do incorporate a lot of funk. And I know that's totally, completely fucking contradictory, and I don't care.
I just told you that I can read the communication. There's a lot of funk in that shrimp dish I had last night.
Oh, yeah.
But it was subtle and balanced.
Right.
So
but that was a trip because me and Chetty had to decide on the dish via telephone. And that was our second dish because the first we were going to do a vegetarian dish first. And we had to nix that because somebody else was picked that vegetable.
Oh, no.
So yeah, the second dish, it was a trip. And we both brought extra ingredients mm-hmm. and kind of reworked the dish as we were going, and it was fun. It came out well, so we're happy.
Yeah, it was excellent. I had a straight up appetizer while we were talking last night. I think I had 4 plates. I'm like, okay, that's like 2 skewers of shrimp at Red Lobster because I know I eat there all the time.
Biscuits, man. I'm sorry. You can call me out. It's fine. I don't care. They're not real biscuits. I fucking love the cheddar biscuits at Red Lobster. They're delicious.
I have the recipe.
Well, you can buy it in a box.
Oh, you
don't need the recipe. You can buy it in a box.
The recipe starts with Bisquick.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you're talking about.
Me and my wife went to Red Lobster and just ate fucking biscuits. It was terrible. Like, we ordered food, but we didn't eat any of it. We just ate biscuits.
Yeah. I actually have never been to Red Lobster, but I make those biscuits.
Well, the biscuits are delicious.
Yeah,
that's delicious. All you need. You don't need anything else from Red Lobster.
It's a drop biscuit.
Which is not my favorite type of biscuit.
Me neither.
We do laminated biscuits at the restaurant.
Oh, you do laminated. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite. I like a fluffy, tall biscuit.
Mm-hmm. I'm former employee of Callie's Biscuits, so I like the cream cheese.
You like cream biscuits?
I like cream biscuits. Yeah, that's just my...
I had this conversation with somebody last night. I really like cream biscuits for desserts. Like, so do you like a shortcake with a cream biscuit?
I do, but I'm not a super shortcake fan. Right. I either want cake, like, sweet.
This is a fight that me and my wife have, because she's a cake person 100%, and I am 100% a pie person.
There's a little SFA chat about that.
She'll compromise on one thing, fry pies.
Fry pies are the shit.
Like, if I put them on the menu and she doesn't, and I don't tell her, she gets pissed.
Oh, yeah.
She gets pissed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
But the funk is something that I think a lot of people that are just dipping their toes into, I hate to use the term, but we all have to now, foodie world, but this world of seeing food differently and a little more intense instead of just sustenance or something to be a cheat.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know why we like it. You know, like, why would you drink a drinking vinegar? Why would you?
It's delicious.
And it has floating things in it.
It's great. I mean, like, part of me thinks it's about, you know, there was a comment made on the panel tonight about refinement of palate comparing, you know, France to Appalachia. And I think that's it kind of upset me. I'm just going to say it. I think that was completely unfair. And I think that us being a nation that's 400 years old and them being a nation that's centuries old has nothing to do with refinement. I think refinement is totally in the eye of a beholder. And I think it's a very pretentious way to approach food.
Mm-hmm.
You like what you fucking like. And it doesn't matter how refined anybody else thinks it is.
Mm-hmm.
It matters what you think. And it's like, you know.
Taste is extremely personal.
Totally. And in the 90s, gourmet was the word, right? It was always gourmet this, gourmet. Gourmet translates to what you like. That literally, the translation is what you like. So it's not about, you know, it could be about developing a palate,
right?
But that's not refining a palate. That's just tasting more things. And your taste buds naturally change and not necessarily progress. Sometimes they degress. My poppy died not being able to taste a thing. And I remember watching the pain on his face eating because he was so upset that he couldn't taste the things that he loved so much.
Right.
You know what I mean? My palate has changed drastically over
Mine has changed drastically.
I'm 40 years old and my palate's changing again.
Yeah.
You know, I quit smoking. Most people oversalt when they quit smoking. I was undersalting everything. And my wife came in the restaurant and ate. She's like, what is wrong with you? It's like, what are you talking about? She's like, nothing is salted enough. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
You couldn't tell.
Now it's leveled back out and my salt is where it should be. And I used to oversalt a little bit. Now I'm a little bit more sensitive and it'll change again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not refinement. That's shifting. It's physiological.
Chemistry.
Yeah, it's molecular. Yeah. It's got nothing to do with anything other than tasting food regularly. That's it.
But something that you consider gourmet
is somebody else's shit.
Right. But you love this fermented thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
It's the complexity.
From a chef's standpoint, it's the complexity.
Yeah, totally. And what it brings to the party. I mean, you know, it's amazing what you can do with three ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for those kids that are putting 15, 20, 30 things on a plate, you know, simplicity. There's beauty in simplicity.
Edit, people. Mm. All I got to say is edit.
And that goes across platforms.
Yeah. Cocktails. Yeah.
Writing. Everything.
What are you trying to say?
Nothing about you, sweetie. Nothing about you. It's just like... It's frustrating.
It's editing.
Yeah.
Editing is the best thing.
Just because you have everything doesn't mean you need to show everything.
Right.
You know, unless Kenny Loggins say, no one to hold them, no one to fold them.
It wasn't Loggins.
It wasn't Loggins. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm going to get shot. Can you edit that?
You know I'm so leaving that in. But anyway. I think on that note.
Anyway.
If people want to learn more about the Shack and Ian's work there in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia, you can go to thesouthernfork.com. If you actually want to eat Ian's food, you can see him at the Shack, but I would suggest definitely clicking on that link once again and making some reservations before you hit in the mountain trail at 7 o'clock at night thinking you just gonna be able to roll in. He also cooks at little joints such as the James Beard House. So you can occasionally see him there, if you're really lucky. But if you like what you hear, and you would love for Ian to actually get out of this car and not die of heat stroke, you best leave a review. Else, he's going to be suffering for a few more hours as I beg you for review. So it's kind of like an NPR pledge drive. Right. Just do it so we can shut up, okay?
Just get it over with.
But thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank
today.
You for having me.
Yeah.
You've been listening to The Southern Fork. I can't wait to bring you more culinary conversations, but in the meantime, I have one question. Are you gonna eat all that?